have questions for either Connie or Kathy?
Or Jean.
Oh, Jean, sorry. Jean, you're sitting back there.
I know, Kathy.
Yeah, maybe we'll move over there. Any questions? Yes, Rosalie?
Okay, I have one about benefit cost analysis that I'm sort of conflicted over personally. And that is, as a practitioner of benefit cost analysis, I, like others, like the empirical-based retrospective kind of thing. But I noticed that with this interest in the science of science policy and the possible attention given to evaluation as to how it can inform science policy, that tilts you more towards prospective benefit cost analysis. And I noticed, for example, in this Chilean request for proposals for designing an evaluation system that they specifically called out prospective benefit cost analysis as a way to inform their science policy. And so, you know, things are going on in other parts of the world. And so I see this tension, you know, I'm not sure quite how to think about it, but I see this tension between the desire of benefit cost analysis for informing as best you can what has happened in a more traditional view of the use of the method, where you really want to avoid, you know, as much uncertainty as possible, to the flip side, where you deliberately go out in a more prospective mode because you're trying to gather more information for future decisions. And so I don't know if you've thought about that balance or not, but
I think it's news to me that the other countries, you've been more involved with what's happening internationally than I have, that's for sure. I wasn't aware of this out seeking for work specifically on the prospective analysis. I do remember back to when we were doing the first benefit cost studies in ATP, and there was no retrospective, and we plunged in with prospective. My own sense is that if you're going to use the results themselves, the prospective analyses are likely not to be accurate enough for that kind of guidance. On the other hand, if you want to learn practice methodologies and start where there isn't a lot of history, you've got an easier chance of doing it prospectively without a lot of history.
Yeah, we did it because we had to,
right,
because
exactly.
We were asked to show what benefits might come about,
right,
and we didn't have any,
right,
because we were a new program,
right,
so we were sort of driven to it. It wouldn't have been our first choice at the time.
Yeah.
Had we had empirical,
right,
results, we would have gone to those first.
Sure,
so,
and we were after numbers. I mean, we were told, right, to come up with numbers.
And also, I think at the time we were thinking about, because of the time and expense of benefit cost analysis, that for a policy tool, it might not be that good, you know, because it takes so long to do it, and often policy decisions are being made faster. So I've sort of wondered about that, you know, balancing also. But anyway, I'm thinking there might be a future for more perspective.
Well, interestingly, though, when we were presenting this at a seminar with the Wren Group, the Washington Research Evaluation Network, one of the comments, OMB criticized ATP for using prospective benefit cost studies, and at the same time, you don't even have to leave the country, the Department of Energy was being encouraged to use prospective benefit cost studies.
Exactly.
But I'd like to add that a lot of the studies that Jean did really combined both. They would have a prospective element as well as a retrospective element. And so I guess that's one approach,
right,
that you can take.
I think you kind of have to do that, or you're waiting so long nobody,
right,
cares about the project anymore and the trail has gone cold.
But you know what's interesting about the prospective BC analysis that we haven't really touched upon is that it really can feed back to program management, meaning when you interview folks and you ask them, you know, how are you calculating these markets that you think you're going to gain and what share and so forth, you kind of get a sense that, you know, the business people and the technical people, they have different ideas about it. You know, that should inform the way we look at proposals as well. I mean, I think that kind of feedback we haven't really explicitly stated, but I think we've talked about it amongst ourselves, especially when you've done the prospective and gone back with the retrospective,
right.
And you're like, oh, my God, how did they make those estimates? And it really depends on who you talk to. It depends on the outlook at the time.
There's a tremendous amount to be learned from the retrospective analyses that we've done already that are kind of generic and the pitfalls that can happen back when you're evaluating a proposal, the pitfalls in preparing the proposal, the optimism, whether it's technical or business economic,
I mean,
what
that,
have you.
That to me is
tremendous lesson.
Right. That to me is like, you know, a paper that you could look at where you look at the prospective, retrospective, you take two or three of them and you say, how did we construct it and what can we learn from that? That to me is very valuable aside from, you know, the actual numbers, you know, but just how you get the process of it.
Well,
I think would be very valuable.
It's sort of interesting in terms of what's happened with the biggest government effort towards prospective benefit cost analysis to date, and that is the congressional directive that came out of a subcommittee, an appropriation subcommittee, that DOE would use a prospective benefit cost analysis that the committee then would use to make budget decisions. And they commissioned the National Academy to do it, and I was on the first wave of that. And so what happened was they got right up to the third phase of the study, which was to do more implementation of how would you set up these prospective benefit cost studies. And the committee changed, and the appropriation was shifted from the existing committee to another committee, and that committee said, eh. And so then DOE was off the hook, and they could use it or not use it. And so they've sort of seemed to be buying into some elements, but not the whole, you know, not the whole package. And the other thing was where the committee ran into a lot of trouble was they were using decision trees with probability estimates to handle the uncertainties. And they were trying to go for a simplified approach, and that blows up on you real fast when you get interdependent projects and you're doing probabilities. Anyway, that kind of got out of hand.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have to wrap this session up because we want to move to our... Oh, we have one more question.
I had a question offline. I'm offline. I mean, on remote.
Just a second. We've got a question in the room first, and then we'll ask... You can ask your question, remote participant. Go ahead.
Yes, the most recent study is online. I will give Susan the link, and then we'll post it, I guess, maybe at the back, the last page, or maybe separately, so you can see it. It's several... maybe 100 pages or so long, but it shows the methodology and it shows the results. And it also talks about the clusters themselves. Yeah.
Okay. And someone joining us remotely? Did you?
Yes. Ravi Sharma here, Susan.
Yes. Hi.
I have a quick question for Jean first and then for Connie and Kathy. Jean, the quick question is that are there parameters in your modeling of benefits and costs that you found that are relevant to one kind of technology versus the other? So, and then there are any actuals in the case studies, I did not see actual data versus what was predicted and what was found to be the actual ROI. Either for private things, for public things, or even third category, which I would call environment.
Dr. Savi, she's reading your chat room question.
Ah, good.
We've got it. Let's, maybe she wants to paraphrase a little bit for the group. Okay, I think.
I'm going to, rather than spend a lot of time here on getting kind of all the caveats, you were talking about kind of generic parameters but you're particularly interested in environmental issues. Let me just say that as part of a benefit cost study, the contract researcher is typically an engineer or has considerable science, that the technical parameters are developed as part of the study, and they're fairly unique to the study. Now, a lot of our projects have been energy savings technologies, and so one parameter and technique is kind of modified as you do the next study, but they're similar. But the technologies themselves are still pretty unique, and it's a custom job to develop the particular technical parameter that then gets combined with typically product sales that then becomes a cash flow that then goes through the standard adjustments of discounting and constant dollars and then forming into net benefits and benefit cost ratio.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Would you like to ask your second question, please, to Connie and to Kathy?
Yes.
I think we can see it. We can see it.
We'll read it here. Let's see. Connie, are there any correlation studies and cluster analysis between patent clusters and related industrial economic growth results?
I don't know.
Meaning which of the patents actually made it to a industry that then benefited in terms of its bottom line or growth in its sales or whatever.
Michael Porter at Harvard has been working with the Council on Competitiveness on regional innovation, and they definitely look at clusters, and they look at geographic clusters. The project that I presented was clearly not geographic clusters. It was technological clusters.
Yes,
so
I was...
I was
interested.
Sorry?
I was interested in technology clusters.
Yes. So my answer back is I really don't know. I think that there's potential. I know that DOE has taken on some of the stuff, some of the work that we did, at ATP in 2002, 2003, and then they've pushed that methodology forward. And then when I was at TA, I turned back and did the same thing with ATP patents again. But I would recommend that you look at the DOE website. Maybe Rosalie knows or Prasad might know. But 1790 Analytics did work with DOE with Bill Valdez, and it could be that I know that they traced DOE technologies to see what kind of impact it had. I'm not sure if it directly linked to industrial economic results or not.
Industry's economic growth. So you have answered, kind of. Yes. I will look into those people's references, Rosalie and Prasad.
Yeah, I just had a comment.
One small thing to add there is that I have background of benefit cost analysis from 1972, working with Oscar Morgenstern to define three types of benefit cost studies for the space shuttle justification for NASA, similar to what you people defined for, speakers defined for the DOE case and National Academy. So I'm very curious to follow this line.
Mm-hmm. I think Prasad wanted to mention.
I had a comment about the relation between patents and economic growth, and kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the USPTO is now doing a study where they're actually trying to link patent classifications to NAICS classifications.
Yeah.
And I think that that'll be...
Oh, very good.
You know, we haven't really seen anything yet from that, but I think that that's the next area that I think economic research is going to go into is delving into analyses that address that linkage.
Yes, and I know for certain that the Department of Commerce, the Secretary of Commerce, put together a standing committee with pretty renowned experts, and they issued a final report on measuring innovation. And that report came out at the end of December, early January of this year. And it talks about, knowledge spillovers. It talks about intangibles and so forth. And there are these direct links.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Connie. We have to end this session and move to the concluding comments.